On today's College Football Inquirer, Ross Dellinger details the divorce between Kyle Whittingham and Utah, and it certainly seems like Utah paid Kyle Whittingham millions of dollars to take a better job. Good work if you can get it. Plus, the SEC is spending less on recruiting these days, at least less on the cookie cakes and balloon arches. Also, is football killing March Madness? We'll discuss today on the College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey. I am Andy Staples, and I am very excited to dig into the topic that we start with today because Ross Dellinger was teasing us with this for much of last week. He knew it was coming. He didn't know exactly when it was coming, but it was a release of documents from the University of Utah that finally dropped on Friday, and Ross had the story about the divorce between Kyle Whittingham and Utah, which led Kyle Whittingham to Michigan. And Ross, it's one of those things that as I read the various emails and documents that you unearthed, my jaw kept falling further to the floor because they offered the man a demotion and then they paid him $13.5 million to take a better job.
Yeah. Pretty revealing. I think most people sort of, you know, like us that work in this industry every day probably knew that Kyle Whittingham wanted to continue coaching. It just didn't work out, but we really didn't know specific details, right? And all those documents make clear that, number one, he wanted to keep coaching. He'd have preferred to get a raise if he were to keep coaching. He asked for a raise for him and his staff, more NIL money. And Utah came back with sort of the opposite.
How about not? Right?
We'll
give the coach in waiting more power. You'll get less power. And if you try to actually exert control over the program, we'll fine you or
we'll
fire
find you.
That was
pretty wild. So it's pretty clear that, and I guess it's important, the history of this is important. I know it's something that we want to touch on about the head coach in waiting, right? Morgan Scali was originally Dean, the head coach in waiting several years ago, right? Then there was an incident that came out about Morgan Scali.
He had a bit of a scandal, and then it was sort of taken away and then given
taken
back.
Taken away. Yeah, but either way, the title had been there for several years. And so there was sort of this long process of waiting for Kyle Whittingham to make a decision. It seemed like every year was going to be, or people around the program at least thought, well, this is going to be the last year. This is going to be the last year. And it just, he always wanted to return. And I think it got to the point where obviously the university administration, in sort of a effort to keep Scali, who's an alum there, from going to get other jobs, which he did apparently turn down other jobs in the years in the past, to keep him, they needed to have Kyle obviously leave at some point to keep him around. So, which leads me to ask Godfrey about what he thinks about the head coaching waiting title.
Look, it's like those meth PSAs. Do you guys remember those in the early aughts where it was like, look, we know you guys smoke marijuana and you drink too much, but meth, not even once. Head coaching waiting, not even once. By the way, I know we're in the middle of March Madness and I know that Creighton's basketball coach just stepped down and they have a head coaching waiting situation.
Yes.
I don't know if this applies to other sports at all. I've only ever really covered this sport. So before people ask or comment, I don't know. By the way, Creighton's head coach that's stepping down, Andy, looks exactly like Kane, like the wrestler.
He does.
Kane. Yeah, he looks exactly like Glenn Jacobs. It's very strange. So far,
good career, Coach McDermott.
Like, this is everyone's within their rights. Let me set the table for the conversation this way. If Utah wants to move on, they can. Should they move on? Is this a good idea for them to move on? Did they anticipate? This is where I kind of want to go to you, Andy, because when the Michigan news broke, we felt like, I think as a trio, we kind of felt like, well, Utah wasn't necessarily flanked, but they didn't expect the party they were trying to sort of expel from the program to then turn around and become the head coach at one of the premier brands in college football, which complicates everything that's said in Ross's story. because now you're actually sort of shifting the spotlight onto the person who's left the program.
Well, and Ross's story really illuminates this. And I want to take you back to that kind of 2-week period in early December when all this happened, because what they're trying to do, if you read the documents, they don't want him to go to BYU. They're worried about him going to BYU. He's not allowed to take a job. If he wants the money, which is this is separation bonus of $13.5 million, $8 million up front, and then the rest over the next 2 years, he can't take another job in the state of Utah. They're obviously not worried about Weber State or Utah State. They're worried about BYU. Why are they worried about BYU? Because as these emails are flying back and forth, Kalani Sitake is a candidate for the Penn State job.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been a worse situation.
That was their concern. I don't think it crossed their minds that somebody might be like, oh, you don't want Kyle Whittingham? Oh my God, we can get Kyle Whittingham?
Well, to Utah's defense a little bit, Andy, given where we were in the progression of the carousel, Witt was not a sort of fit. Didn't mean to rhyme, sorry. It didn't seem like he would be a front runner at any of the jobs at that point in the cycle.
Correct.
Michigan was an unforeseen circumstance, right? Sort of a comet that hits with everything that goes on with Moore, and we're finding out with his assistants and everything else, but just giant mess in Ann Arbor. I don't think any decision maker in Salt Lake City could have forecasted that. And then even after that, guys, think about the journey that Michigan goes on to land at Whittingham. He wasn't, I don't know if he was their first choice, but he wasn't out of the gate the first person I think they thought of, right? We had the long cup of coffee with the head coach at Alabama currently, right? So there's no way to forecast this. However, this is one of many reasons why you should never embrace the concept of head coach in waiting.
You never know what's going to happen, right? Like, when you're deeming somebody that, you're sort of like projecting, obviously, and you're predicting sort of the future, and none of us can really do that. And it sort of put Utah in this bind, right? The title sort of that they bestowed on Morgan. And I get why they did it in a way, right? They tried to keep him from other jobs, but
yeah.
It forced them sort of into this position. And yes, this would not be as big of a story if Kyle Whittingham didn't go to Michigan. It would have sort of been more of a normal, in a way, exit that happens with sort of legendary coaches. We've seen it a lot actually through the years, right? Bobby Bowden in Florida State comes to mind. But this one changed as soon as he took the Michigan job, which happened just 2 weeks right after they separated with him. And then 2 weeks later, he got paid $8 million. And by the way, his salary at Michigan, I believe, is $8 million too. So Kyle has a lot of money.
Well, yeah. one of the things
Kyle could give Michigan a discount because of that money.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was obvious. The numbers are obvious that he was not interested in the money. Like, based on the correspondence that comes out in this story, and that, like, he was interested in still coaching. So Utah maybe didn't understand their position that they were operating from was actually pretty weak. It wasn't about finances. Now, had he stayed at Utah, he did want more money for NIL, but this "we'll pay you to go away" was never going to work as a strategy.
Yeah, I do wonder, like, had they come back with, "we're happy to have you continue, we're not going to give you the raise, but we'll give you the staff pool raise and the NIL money you want," I would assume he'd say yes to that.
I think so, definitely. Yeah, I mean, given the state of Utah's roster and the consistency and their ability to win in the Big 12, I think he's still there if that's the case.
And the amazing thing to me is I don't know, and yes, the coach in waiting thing complicates everything. I'm not sure Utah understood what they had. Now, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe Kyle Whittingham doesn't level up at Michigan the way I think he will.
Okay.
But I think there were the majority of programs in college football, if their coach decided to become a monk tomorrow and somebody said, "you can have Kyle Whittingham as your coach," most of them would be like, "yep, sounds good. We're good with that."
Maybe 2/3 of the field would be leveling up.
Yes.
In the FBS.
Yes.
2/3, like automatically. Yeah.
Now, that Kyle Whittingham is specifically the type of person Michigan needed in that moment is probably why he's there right now. But for Kyle Whittingham, who has toiled at Utah for 20 seasons, 21 seasons as the head coach and moved them through multiple conferences and made them competitive at higher, you know, increasingly higher levels, I'm sure this is something he wanted. He wanted to be at a place where you can win national titles. So now we get to see if he can. And I am fascinated. Like, this is so endlessly interesting to me, this whole situation, because somebody's going to come off looking incredibly dumb at the end of this.
And this is why head coach in waiting, all joking aside, is a really inopportune strategy for everyone involved. Utah needed to go to Whittingham for whatever reasons. And Andy, I feel like you're sort of hinting around the idea of like, we're not really sure why Utah was so hell bent on severing this relationship. If we just got, like I just got done saying, and you guys agreed that if he replaced another coach in the FBS, 2/3 of the programs would be better tomorrow.
It may be one of those things, situations where like guy's been married to his smoking hot wife for 20 years and forgets that he's got a smoking hot wife. In those last years,
it's like
gets used to, hey, you're the person I come home to every day.
Yeah.
Sometimes we drive each other crazy and that's not fun. And maybe I want this younger person here.
There's a new young person who laughs at my jokes a little longer than my, than my betrothed. Stay off the internet.
I think every that's one of what happened here. I really do.
You know what though, in that, both in the metaphor and reality, that doesn't end well for anybody. Okay.
Nope.
The dude just looks really awkward as he approaches his mid-60s and, you know, he's out there in the dating pool. It's going to be rough for Utah,
I predict.
She
gets her revenge body and she usually turns out just fine. So
it would
Kyle
be different
Whittingham
too.
Revenge body. Is
Kyle Whittingham already has the revenge body. I mean, he hasn't missed a workout since 1982. Yeah.
He is the middle-aged male ideal of like, I'm going to be that guy, the grind set workout every day thing that Andy loves. Like, you love to talk about. How many days has he gone without missing a workout?
I don't even know where the streak's at, but it's insane.
Cool. Yeah, I worked out yesterday. I'm not going to do it today.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it today.
It's, a couple of things.
But you
here.
Know, this would all be different, right? Like because he went 8-5 in 23 and 5-7, right? And then a lot of people kind of thought, especially around the program last year after the 5-7 in 2024, that he was done. And I think there was a lot of intent by the university to make that happen, you know, a year before all this, because that was the year also that Morgan Scali got the head coach in waiting tag
back.
In 24. So I think everything was building up to this happening in December 24. And when it didn't, I think there was just like an automatic sense that, well, it's definitely happening next year. And then he went 10-2.
Right. But
7-2 in the league.
That's why you don't do it. There's a couple things I want to talk about from a strategy perspective. And also, without really passing judgment one way or the other on Scali, this is poor positioning on everybody's part. You're taking a young rising star that you've identified, but you've also not identified them or sort of believed in them enough in the public opinion to give them the job, right? There are ways to do this. And the way you do this is that none of us know until it happens. So I'm thinking about Bob Stoops and Lincoln Riley at Oklahoma. Bob Stoops, I believe it was late April. I think I was in an NFL planning meeting at SB Nation where I got a phone call. Hey, Bob Stoops is retiring right now.
Oh, I think it was June. I was on
June.
I knew it was a weird time of year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was very much off the cycle.
I'm trying to remember because just talking to people involved in that whole situation, I'm pretty sure Stoops had brought it up with Joe Castiglione, the athletic director at Oklahoma, months earlier. So,
right.
But to your point,
but not
we
publicly.
Didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We never had time to play the game that everybody does, usually at the expense of the younger promising coach, which is, who's better? What you do is you force these two individuals who are usually sharing a staff together, one's a superior and one's a subordinate, to then be compared in a really impossible way. How would we know if this young, promising head coach talent that's going to be elevated up eventually is a worthy successor to the individual he is still working for? That's an unfair value proposition for everyone involved, that's the number one reason before we jump into any of the examples that we can cite in the last 20 years. That's just bad business for everybody. It doesn't make the brand look good. It's actually counterintuitive to what the ADs and the school presidents are pushing, which is we're going to have consistency here. when in actuality, what you're doing is it's like these people have never heard of a message board. It's an instant it's an instant referendum on both the past, present, and future of your program. And it's an unearned level of scrutiny wherein what you can do is just
Morgan
simply,
Scali can go 9-3.
And how is that going to compare to the
disappointing in year one? Like that's unfair to him completely.
And Andy, Utah is kind of a poor example here because of the magnitude that this thing has been elevated because of the Michigan hire of Whittingham. If you look at some of these previous situations, it's rough on everybody involved. The one that, if you go through in history, probably the best example of this, and I kind of want to air quote this, and Andy, you were there, so you'd probably remember some of the details that I heard after the fact. Bobby Bowden, set to retire. Jimbo Fisher has had this really interesting journey. He's almost the head coach at University of Alabama, Birmingham, and the University of Alabama scuttles that. And there's all this, like, Jimbo Fisher was as hot as you could have been when he was hired as the offensive coordinator for Florida State en route to an eventual national championship in 2013, January 14, right? Yep. Okay. That was technically a seamless transition, but everyone I've ever for our audio only listeners, there were finger quotes.
Yeah,
there was a serious issue. There was a serious power play at hand. Guess what happened? It's the same thing that happened with Mack Brown and Will Muschamp at the University of Texas before Will Muschamp left that head coach in waiting arrangement to succeed Urban Meyer at Florida. The only difference here is that they held on to Jimbo in the Florida State case. So I guess technically it was successful. But ask anybody in the Bowden camp, Andy. Like, when that transition occurred, it was not a peaceful handover of power, right?
No.
It was a lot of sort of bending the finger back privately.
Well, they fired Bobby Bowden. They had to fire the greatest, you know, one of the greatest coaches of all time. And I was there that day watching Andrew Carter, our friend, who went on to the Raleigh News and Observer after that, but he was the Orlando Sentinel, Florida State beat writer, like chasing the AD Randy Spetman into the elevator. Randy Spetman, who is a, you know, like decorated military officer running away from reporters because he doesn't want to explain why he fired Bobby Bowden, but everybody knows he fired Bobby Bowden. And they're trying to portray it as something that Bobby Bowden wanted. He didn't want it. Right. And it was interesting because as I was reading the counteroffer that Utah sent to Kyle Whittingham, it actually reminded me a lot of the situation with Bowden and Jimbo Fisher when Jimbo Fisher was the OC. But that was more Bowden ceded that stuff to Jimbo Fisher, which allowed Jimbo to have the power base that when it was time to make the play, he made the play. Now, look, you can argue that he did that was actually what was best for Florida State because they were going down under Bowden.
Yes.
Like they were falling.
Yeah. And
It had to happen. Right. There's the famous story.
They went like 7-6 three out of 4 years, I think.
Yeah,
they were just mediocre.
Did one of you guys write the story where you went in, talked to Jimbo, and like when he took over, they were still using VHS tape? Was that one of you guys?
That wasn't me, but I have heard that from Jimbo Fisher.
Yeah. Before. Wow. Like, I think it may have been like a common anecdote he used. Yeah. When he takes over in Tallahassee, which this is the year, Andy,
2010,
they're still using VHS. Mm. There's a portion of our listenership that doesn't know what I'm saying.
Doesn't know what VHS is.
What that is.
Right.
It was the thing before DVDs, which are the things that you probably only used when you were kids.
A long time
ago. At that point, it was probably 10 years into the DVD era. In 2010?
That I can confirm as a former Blockbuster video employee. Don't worry about it, kids. It was the coolest job you could have.
That was the most successful of these, and it still involved the very acrimonious, essentially firing of one of the greatest coaches of all, tells you how bad these things usually go. Joe Tiller to Danny Hope at Purdue. Yeah. May have set the program back. I mean,
I don't know.
James Franklin was supposed to be Ralph Regan's coach in waiting at Maryland.
One of my favorite stories, Andy, because up until the point, at least up until last time I think I was in his office was the second or third year at Penn State. So this would include his early run at Penn State, his entire run at Vanderbilt. He had his pitch deck, this sort of giant three-prong folder for how he was going to run whatever year that was, whatever the coming year was. I can't remember the date for Maryland football. He would keep it on his desk. Yeah. Like James Franklin is that level sometimes of like petty, like that's the fuel that he runs best on. He kept that Maryland proposal for how he was going to be head coach after Ralph Regan on his desk for years after years. That motivated him. Like when Maryland and Penn State got put in the same division, the Big Ten. Oh man, he enjoyed that.
The coach in waiting thing at Texas was probably the one that got the most attention when Muschamp was named Mac Brown's coach in waiting. And that seemed ill-advised from the start because Mac Brown at that point, they play for the national title in 2009. They had the bad year in 2010. You know, it felt like it was as that 2010 season went on, it felt like a way for them to just push Mac out. And then Mac didn't want to leave. Fortunately for them, Florida comes along and offers Muschamp the job.
Yeah. Was that the first one? Like, I guess the high profile, maybe.
I think it's the first one.
What happened before that? The Joe Tiller to Danny Hope handoff was before that. There were a few other ones before that.
The biggest problem with the tech, well, there's, you could talk about the Texas situation in a number of ways. You know, Mac Brown's ability to politic the state, we've talked about that historically on the show before, like his ability to work as sort of a statesman and less of a head coach. Like, he kind of birthed the CEO concept of what it takes to run one of these major, you know, billion-dollar, like, properties. That's what college football teams have become. Will Muschamp was not that guy. Will Muschamp was the complete opposite. And it's very similar, Andy, to Utah in that Texas kind of got a little too comfortable with what they had, got a little bored with what they had. In this case, he had won them a national championship. He'd lost another. And yet there was this restlessness that they needed to do better. A lot of that was informed by Bob Stoops at Oklahoma, going to the postseason with more, or going to sort of the national championship picture with more consistency and frequency. And then they kind of made a left field hire. I'm not saying that Muschamp and Scalia are the same here, but Muschamp was very much a sort of opposite of Mac Brown in many, many ways. You guys also remember, and maybe the listeners don't, Will Muschamp was the hottest commodity in coaching at the time. He was the red hot defensive coordinator, Saban protege. He had been on all the staffs. This was the guy who could take over your program. There was none. There really was no hotter candidate in college coaching.
Was it the John Summerall of the 2010, 2009 coaching cycle?
John Summerall, I think, has seen Star Wars, though.
That's exactly right. Yeah, but similar situations where it felt like they'd worked at every SEC program by that point. And, you know, And that was a hot thing at the time because that, you know, Jimbo Fisher's taking over from Bobby Bowden right then. So it was just a thing people did back then. And I thought it had kind of ended because the more closer to it. Now, Ryan Day, I think, effectively was Ohio State's coach in waiting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. During the 2018 season, I think Urban Meyer had told Gene Smith. And Gene Smith talked about he actually did look outside a little bit, but then decided Ryan Day was the best guy. But that's not the same thing. Ryan Day didn't sit there for 3 years waiting for the job.
I've got one. Yeah. I've got one that was inarguably successful, but it was under a very specific circumstance. One, Bobbert Petrino comes back into coaching after being disgraced. I covered this hiring press conference because it was very close to Nashville. And also, it was like such a rubberneck story from a national viewpoint of Bobby Petrino coming back into coaching after the scandal at Arkansas. He goes to Western Kentucky. And while it is not expressly stated at his hiring press conference when he returned to college football, the understanding at every level at Western Kentucky was, I am going to coach this team in Conference USA for 1 year, and then I'm going to hand this off to the offensive coordinator who's on this staff by the name of Jeff Brohm, and then I'm out of here. Don't bother me with this. I'm doing 1 year of CUSA football and then I'm taking whatever job I can. And he held true to that. And what's funny about that in hindsight is that every time Bobby Petrino leaves somewhere, he usually leaves it in smoldering ash. Coaches have talked about for years having to rebuild the culture from the very, very bottom up. Like, this was something that really plagued Brett Bielema at Arkansas because he had to just sort of, like, you know, they were in a year negative one. They weren't even in a year zero.
Yes. Satterfield will tell the stories about taking over at Louisville. Yes.
Absolutely. The funny thing about that was Western Kentucky achieved, I think they had a decent season under Petrino, and then they really took off under Brohm. And the reason why was Brohm was on staff, and he had sort of worked it out to where Petrino was not actually interfacing with the team all that much, and they sort of Petrino-proofed the situation, where it was really kind of Brohm's team from the very, very jump. You can ask people who were there. I've talked to a lot of people who are on, you know, it's right up the road from me in Nashville. I spent some time at Western Kentucky, but that's the only example. Now, there's one other thing, Andy, I want to mention. There's one other way to use this concept effectively as a bulwark against problems. It's the secret head coach in waiting.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
All right.
I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I direct
Not
you back
public, huh?
As I am legally
kind of Ryan Day.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, Ryan Day.
So
that's what I
am,
of, yeah.
As I am apparently legally obligated to do at least once a podcast, reference the always interesting University of Mississippi, my alma mater. There was a point in time. Let me tell you about Will Muschamp for a second. Will Muschamp was South Carolina's head coach during the height of the Hugh Freeze saga in Mississippi, where he and Dan Mullen are,
good work.
You know, he and Dan Mullen are waging a cold war with the NCAA against each other, yada, yada, yada. I wrote a few books about it. At the height of this, when things are starting to go bad at the Kremlin, if you will, the Kremlin in Oxford, Mississippi, Will Muschamp, head coach of South Carolina, makes a very lucrative offer to offensive line coach and Ole Miss alumni and former player Matt Luke to basically kind of come and kind of fortify his staff. And Luke is really thought of as like, he is sort of the quintessential glue guy, I think is a good way to describe Matt Luke. I really wouldn't pass judgment on him for his head coaching record at Ole Miss, because the NCAA kind of nuked their roster for years and years, and Luke was just sort of stuck cleaning up the mess before they got all the money for Kiffin. But Ole Miss is in this situation where they can't really afford to match the offer from South Carolina. It makes sense career-wise for Luke to leave his alma mater and kind of go out and make his own way, right? But the athletic director, currently the AD at Ohio State, Ross Bjork at the time, tells everybody, hey, empty out your pockets. We have to match this offer from South Carolina. Why? Because, and this was an open secret in Oxford at the time, what Ross Bjork was telling everyone is, I'm going to have a head coach when this one inevitably gets whacked by the NCAA or various massage parlors or who knows what, right? Because of the litany of turmoil that Freeze had going into that football season. And this has happened before, and this is also happening right now in college football. ADs who smell something foul and know that there's going to be a problem but can't actually move on dismissing a head coach always have one guy. And I guarantee you, if you call any athletic director, Ross, at any major football program right now, every AD has an assistant coach on staff, and that's the button that they would push in this moment to say, get us out of this mess, or at least just sort of manage this through the hospice season that we're going to have to
have. Yeah, usually if you see assistant head coach next to the guy's name, sometimes it's coordinator, but if you see assistant head coach next to a position coach's name, that's the break glass in case of emergency coach. So
also Matt Luke could do this as a service. He could just pop in and take care
listen,
of it. Like, yeah.
But you've heard my Ed Orgeron
all-time
interim coach business plan. I mean, he could do it too.
Yeah, that's true.
Utah didn't do that.
No.
Utah's put itself in a crazy spot. If Kyle Whittingham's good at Michigan, it's gonna look bad at Utah. If Morgan Scalley isn't awesome at Utah, he's gonna be unfairly judged. It's a tough spot for everybody, but man,
not for Whittingham.
Soap opera.
Whittingham's doing great.
Yeah, Whittingham's just getting paid.
He's got money, and it doesn't really matter. And a guaranteed job, guaranteed money for several more years, and maybe two more payments of a bonus coming. Yeah.
Oh, they're paying it. If they paid the first $8 million after he swiped the OC and the best edge rusher, they're still paying.
Is he doing a home gym every day? Like, he can afford it now. He just did, like, you know how The Rock has the tractor trailer?
Sure, he can afford home gyms at all his properties.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. True. Dude, that's how you keep, that's how you stay consistent. You don't have to deal with a crappy hotel gym.
When we come back, possibly the end of an era in college football. SEC recruiting budgets are dropping.
Gasp.
Inflation.
Whatever will we do without the cookie cakes? We'll be right back. College Football Inquirer, and I always love when I get a text in our group chat from Stephen Godfrey with a link to a story that we all need to read, because it's always going to be fun. And the one that came down earlier this week from AL.com. Stephen Godfrey points out that SEC teams are spending millions less on recruiting than they used to. And before you go, well, no dip, Sherlock, that's because they can pay the players now. I think you got to understand, and Godfrey, I'm going to let you just wax rhapsodic about this, that this is a beloved, cherished part of college football for many of us sickos. Like, I want to know how many lobsters each recruit ate on the official visit. When it became tradition to have a cookie cake in the hotel room every time somebody came on a visit, and recruits got legitimately mad if there was no cookie cake.
This is true. This is true.
Like, this was a meaningful time in my life. And so the fact that schools aren't spending money on this anymore just makes me a little sad.
Really? You feel like nostalgic for the old days?
No, okay. But I think it's funny as hell.
Yeah. Okay.
First off, shout out to young Matt Stahl at AL.com. He wrote this piece and they pulled a lot of records. So always love to see the good young journalists doing the work. This is funny for a number of reasons. One, this was probably this area of spending, I think you guys would agree, was always the most chastised, sort of gilded, thought of as superfluous. The premier example of excess that was going on in college sports before name, image, and likeness in the transfer portal, it changed everything, right? Because this was the nonsense, guys. This was the ridiculousness. So in Matt's story, he identifies correctly that some of the, let's call it nonsense spending, has declined somewhat significantly in the line item budgets of these universities in the Southeastern Conference. Now, before everyone freaks out and complains or worries, that's because they're paying the players now. So what we're automatically seeing in what would we say, guys, 4 years of data, about 4 years, four or five years of data of NIL, we're already seeing a change in spending in recruiting, because rather than actually just giving people a bunch of nonsense or providing a sort of like luxury weekend, you can just simply pay the players. This is, I would say, not coming as a shock to anybody in the industry, Ross. And I would also be really curious, as our resident reporter, how would one evaluate money being spent on facilities in the same amount of time? Because my hypothesis is that if you were to somehow look at the spending projects for buildings, you know, so football facilities, locker rooms, however you want to categorize it, there's been a noticeable shift away from dumping $80, $90, $100, $200 million into facilities as well.
Yes. In fact, we've seen multiple schools just throughout the NIL era, right? Stop. We talked a little bit about Ole Miss, obviously, and they were one of them, right? Maybe 3 years ago, two or three years ago, they were supposed to. Yeah, they were supposed to do a renovation, a multi-million-dollar renovation of the stadium, I believe, right?
Yeah, stadium's pretty rough. Yes, they were supposed to rework an entire side of it, and they came out publicly and just said, the AD, Keith Carter, said, that money's going to the roster.
Yeah, and that was obviously when Lane was there, so I'm assuming he was also behind the fact that, hey, you know, we need to pay the players more, not build new facilities.
It worked!
We've seen a lot of that.
By the way, then Lane complained about the facilities when he left for LSU.
Shocking. We've seen a lot of that, right? We're in recruiting budgets and facility spending. And what else? Where else have we seen we're seeing the reduction in Olympic sport, whether it's staffs or just any kind of resources.
Wait, you don't have to pay travel, a softball coach $1 million?
No, you do not.
I don't know that.
Texas Tech.
Patty Gasso makes $1 million, and she deserves every penny. So I may be overstating that number. So,
well, when you needed to zero out on your budget, that's when you needed to pay the softball coach $500,000, because you couldn't spend that football revenue, on the player, paying the players. So you did it through facilities in Olympic sports.
Now, there's a lot of folks in stuff, athletic
recruiting budgets.
Yeah, that. Their jobs exist because they had to zero out that number. They had to spend all the money that football made. And now
there's a very uncomfortable reckoning going on. But it's interesting because, especially in football recruiting departments, it's shifting because, like, the numbers don't drop that dramatically when you think about how dramatically recruiting itself is changing. Because even big time schools, they're not bringing as many players in on official visits from high school. I've had a group of 5AD tell me that they've told their coaches, don't bring transfer portal guys on official visits because they'll either take the money we're offering or not. Like, it's not worth it. So that dollar figure, like, that spend is actually going down fairly significantly. But what the reason why the numbers aren't just plummeting to zero is you're shifting it to, if you're a big time school, you need a big time GM. So now you've got to pay that person a lot of money. So whereas before you had, you know, dozens of recruiting staffers sending the notes and sending the text messages and maintaining the relationships with the high school players. Now it doesn't matter because you're going to call their agent. You're going to make the offer financially. They're going to figure out yes or no. But you're paying a few people at the top a lot more to decide which of those guys you're going to offer the most money to.
Yeah, this is efficiency. This is why you would hire an analyst. This is why you would hire a consulting group to come in for any style of business. And if you're listening to this and you don't work in our industry, you're probably nodding along and said, yeah, that's what we hire consultants for all the time. And when it doesn't matter if what kind of business you run, a law firm, logistics, trucking, this is how the free market dictates the size and the efficiency of or how you scale your company. And that's what we're doing now. Instead of dumping ridiculous amounts of money into very silly things, I have a question for you guys. How many NFL locker rooms have you walked into? I mean, the actual physical space. Handful?
A few.
Right.
Yeah, very few. And they pale in comparison to top 30 in college football.
I remember when I worked at the Tampa Tribune covering Bucks practices when they were working out of trailers and they had just won the Super Bowl.
Yes. Ross, you were, I think, weren't you covering LSU when the ridiculous new locker rooms with the lay down beds and the cryo chambers that look like they're
from
alien? No,
I was not, but it was right after I left. They were sort of working on it.
Oh, I got to look at the ones that Florida put in a few years ago.
Yeah.
I was snapping pictures of it and sending it to my former teammates because we only had a wooden stool in front of the stall for the longest time.
I think a lot of people listening who are not familiar with the industry might be shocked to know that a Super Bowl winning franchise, I haven't been in the Seattle Seahawks locker room, but I'm willing to bet you that there are 10 to 15 to 20 locker rooms in college football that are inarguably nicer, filled with more bells and whistles, more nonsense. How many times when you guys would go visit a campus, especially in the off season, the SID or the ops guys walking you around, and you know what they start doing? They get really proud. I've been on 100 of these tours in my career and I have to smile through all of them where they go, so check this out. This is where you can get your hair cut if you want. So there's a barber's chair here. And then
there's always a barber's chair.
We got ping pong tables and an Xbox. Yeah. And I'm thinking that's what we had in my college apartment when we were all living below the poverty line. So there was there's all this nonsense investment for the better part of 20 years to slough off that cash because you had to show zero on the balance sheet at the end of the year. Or then someone might notice you were actually making a profit in this business off of unpaid labor. And now you don't have to do that. So,
It's twofold too, Godfrey, right? It's like you're trying to get do something with the money, the football profit. You need to do something with it so you can get to that zero. But two, you're trying to do something with it to entice recruits because you can't pay them, which reminds me of a story. I've said this before. I think I've told this story on the pod before, but like 4 years ago, University of Georgia opened a brand new football facility, and it's like it was amazing, right? And they toured me through it, and Godfrey, I got a lot of the same things. Here we have this and that, and it was amazing. And so I walked into Kirby Smart's office, and I said, "Wow, that facility that I just walked through is probably better than every single NFL facility." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, that's what happens when they won't let us pay the players." And it just always stuck with me.
Good for
now,
Kirby.
For other reasons, you're laughing, I know. But but it stuck with me.
That's
as
good
like,
for Kirby
you know
to
what?
Say it.
This
is also, I think it was when we first started this incarnation of the Inquirer, I think it was right before the season started, a bunch of Texas Tech fans got mad at me on social when I said, that's why Texas Tech is good now. And I know everyone's thinking, well, no, duh, yeah, you can pay him. There was all of these kind of nonsense narratives back then of, well, that town's not, that college town's not fun, or it's far from home, or why would you go to Lubbock if you could go party in Austin, or hey, College Station is closer to home. You know what cuts through all that crap if you're 22? Cash. Mm-hmm. Lubbock is a lot more fun to hang out in now that you can be paid to play football in Lubbock. And everyone gets, Tech fans get really sensitive when I say that. Embrace it. You are running a business and you've done it very well thus far.
This is one of the things that bothers me most about the new era. Like when Jackson Cantwell committed to Miami over Georgia, Jackson Cantwell was the number one offensive tackle recruit in the class of 2026. We did a show explaining, hey, this is something that probably wouldn't have happened pre-NIL era. He's probably going to Ohio State or Georgia or Alabama, and that's it. He's probably not even considering anybody else. But he was considering Missouri. He was considering Miami. And it was... the Miami fans got so angry.
Really?
Like, don't you know we have one of the best offensive line coaches? I'm like, yes, Alex Mirabal is one of the best offensive line coaches.
Yeah.
I agree.
Also,
that
money.
That said, it's still the money that got you in the hunt, and that's okay. Like, we...
I think fans want to believe,
not all fans, but some fans want to believe that the player picked their school because they love the school just as much as the person going there.
And the colors and the logo and love it.
But take it from somebody who walked on at a major college program in the mid-90s. Most of the people weren't there because of their enduring love of the school. They were there because they fit in the coach's offense. Because... yeah. They liked the assistant coach because they felt like they could get developed for the NFL better that way. Like, I didn't pick my school because I loved it. I picked it because it was free.
But Andy, you're speaking against the marketing deck of all these conferences and universities and networks, and it just means more. And it's home here in this college town. And here's an episode of True South about the barbecue. Here's the reality. My parents were hellbound on my sister and I going to a small college town. They were obsessed with it. I remember this vividly of like, you don't want to go to a big city. Bad things happen in a big city, right? And so that's kind of one of the reasons I ended up in Oxford. Also, they paid me to go. Promptly lost those scholarships. My sister had a full ride offer from Georgia Tech, but Atlanta was a big, bad city. Let me tell you something. If my sister had been a college basketball player and they were offering $1 million at Georgia Tech and they were offering less than that in Oxford or Starkville or any of these other idyllic college towns, you know what my parents would have said? Have fun in Five Points, baby.
Welcome
you know
to
what?
Atlanta, mm-hmm. where the players play.
Yeah. Right, I'll check you out on Buckheads.
Like every day.
Let me tell you something. That's the problem right now, is that nobody wants to say the thing out loud because we have marketed all of this sort of postcard visage for so long in college sports of like, these football players, they come to Oxford, they come to Athens, and they're home. No, they're not. No, they're not. They're there for a job.
It is funny. I still laugh when recruits say, I picked it because of the family atmosphere.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
Kiss my ass.
You weren't picking it because of the family atmosphere back in the day either. You're picking it because of the duffel bag. But
damn right.
Or you had to say the family atmosphere. Then you don't have to say it anymore.
Or a convenient title for a Dodge Charger in your uncle's name.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Yep. Listen, I've never even been to an auto auction, Godfrey. How would I know?
Look, a lot of things happen with those flood vehicles. Okay. I'm just saying.
Dodge Charger.
Well, this is why.
One of the biggest selling fleet vehicles in America. Not an accident, by the way.
I wonder why. It ain't because of the cops.
This is why, though, all this whole conversation about the Blue Bloods not being able to lean just on their, you know, brand and historic relevance anymore.
Yeah.
That money's involved, and it brings schools in like, say, Indiana, you know?
Which, ironically, has a nice... I mean, Bloomington's a nice town. sorry, guys. They caught a stray there. Yeah. But no, it's just as simple as money.
It does eliminate some probably superfluous steak and lobster dinners.
Yeah. Mm.
Which, you know, as someone who likes to eat steak and lobster, that does hurt my heart a little bit because I did like the Willie Williams recruiting diary when he's talking about going to Florida State and just ordering extra lobsters when he realizes he can order as much as he wants.
Yes, the meat market, Bruce Feldman's book has a lot of anecdotes of where the kids are just like, you know what, I can really cash out on this tab right now. And you can take to-go bags and all this kind of stuff.
Who hasn't been at the first company dinner of their lives?
Yeah.
Where you realize, this faceless corporation is paying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, could you bring the wine list back out?
Uh-huh. Yeah. That cocktail menu again, please.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what? It's okay. We'll be here for a while. Yeah,
Seafood this is Tower sounds great. Bring two.
I think as long as you asked an individual that was working for a football program of means, the people in the industry would prefer it this way. You don't have to do this nonsense. You don't have to dance the dance. You don't have to have as many back channel conversations with the bagmen and all the black market compensation and this whole rigmarole that used to go into these weekends. Now, I'm sure instead of the Seafood Towers, Andy, simply corresponding with an individual, hopefully the agent is of, you know, is above board in some regard and just saying, hey, what's the number? This is the number mm-hmm. we can offer. And then we're going to move on. And it becomes really a version of NFL free agency.
And much cleaner, much easier, much more expensive in certain positions, but you don't have to have everybody sending text messages and handwriting notes. Though some people still handwrite notes because, you know, it's a lost art. So
people are going to yell at me after this episode publishes because I said, like, because I'm making fun of these kids showing up and be like, Lubbock was home. It's okay that it's the money. The point is to win. The point is not to, you don't run the Chamber of Commerce for these cities.
Home's a lot nicer when you got a bigger paycheck.
Yeah.
Also, your money goes a long way in Lubbock.
No kidding. Buy some property, dude. Invest in some condos.
Hell yeah. Never too early to become a real estate magnate.
There's the Florida man talking.
Ross's coworker, Dan Wolkin, with a very interesting take. And I'm probably extrapolating just a little bit, but I'm not wrong here. Dan is blaming football for the death of Cinderella in March Madness.
Mm.
We'll explain. We are back to College Football Inquirer, and as the NCAA tournament has gotten chalkier and chalkier, everybody's looking for a reason to pin on the death of Cinderella. I don't know that Cinderella is absolutely dead. I mean, Siena was leading Duke by double digits at halftime, probably would have won the game had they had more than five players capable of playing. They had some eligibility issues, injury issues. You know, Santa Clara loses on a incredibly lucky shot from Kentucky that forces overtime. Santa Clara loses in overtime. So it's not necessarily dead, but I do understand, based on margins of victory, based on how things are working, that it is much harder to have a Cinderella in the NCAA tournament in this era. And Dan Wolkin, Ross's colleague at Yahoo, had a very interesting column about this, and he didn't say football was at fault. That wasn't the headline he created, but if you just work back from the conceit of the column, it is football. Because what Dan pointed out, and he's correct in this, by the way, is that conference realignment is what changed the dynamics of the NCAA basketball tournament. As you had teams moving, quote unquote, up in conference, you had backfilling. And what you have now is the champion of Conference USA, for example, is not nearly as good of a team, if you look at the advanced metrics, as the champion of Conference USA would have been in 2005.
Mm. Yes.
And that's what's different now.
Yeah, leagues are getting watered down, right? Because their best schools or programs are moving on. We see it. Yeah, we see it in football, right? I mean, that's one of the issues with why they changed the playoff format for next year, where the four power conferences are each guaranteed a spot. And you just have one G5, and why the conversation, or G6, why the conversation will continue about that one G6 spot and if they should get an automatic qualifier is because there's a thought that one G6 spot will continue to be less and less successful in any kind of playoff because the G6's best programs, right? But over the years, you go through the Houstons and the Cincinnatis in the American,
Utah,
BYU. Yeah. I mean, they've moved up. And so thus the division below is sort of more watered down.
I feel like a hypocrite if I don't acknowledge that as someone who kind of sounded the klaxon on what was going on in football for so long that I can't sit here and bemoan the state of college basketball. It has a, like, things cascade. There's a butterfly effect to these things. And the transfer portal has to apply to basketball if it applies to football. And we're 3 years removed from the last kind of, well, the last run that I remember of a sort of strange Cinderella, which is the Florida Atlantic making the Final Four. That was 3 years ago, okay? And then if we want to play like, hey, remember some guys, there's Mercer, there's Lehigh, Florida Gulf Coast, George St. Mason. Peter's, George Mason, like all of these schools that you sort of only know, when I was younger, it was Bucknell beating Kansas. That's the kind of March Madness storyline that we were conditioned to. That once in a while, a blue blood would get knocked off by a nobody, that nobody would make a run, probably peter out by the eight. And that's kind of how we defined March Madness. The reality is that if you're going to have a senior or talent-laden team at Florida Atlantic or Gulf Coast or any of these schools that I just named, those kids have and should have the right, after they make a run or after they have a decent season, to move up and go to another school. I am okay with that. What I am not okay with, and I just think is ludicrous, is if we have to kill Cinderella, let's kill it. Texas basketball, Texas men's basketball, is not Cinderella. I agree with
that.
No,
that's the highest seeded remaining team in the tournament.
But 11 seed,
absolutely not. Absolutely, like, stop with this nonsense. They're like, well, the new Cinderella's come from the S. No, just stop. Texas is the richest athletic program.
I mean,
program.
It okay when NC State, could we call that NC State team that made the Final Four with DJ Burns Jr. as Cinderella?
Because here's
that
why.
Guy was should have been playing offensive tackle and was tearing it up in the tournament.
Andy, that team had to win the ACC tournament to make the NCAA tournament.
Correct. Yes.
If you want to do that, it is impossible for me to call the University of Texas at Austin a Cinderella in anything. Okay, look at their finances. They are not the Cinderella in any situation. They can spin their way out of any problem. They had a borderline team this year that caught fire at the right time, and that's okay. But they are not Cinderella guys.
They have a high dollar roster with good athletes, and those can get hot at the right time.
Yes.
And they have a good coach in Sean Miller.
I don't know how all this squares, because I'm not a basketball person, with the Miami of Ohio controversy and Bruce Pearl lobbying, obviously, for his son's team, Auburn, over them. And like, that's a whole other paradigm, but we should embrace the small school and the weird moment. That's part of March Madness. But we also don't have to just take that Cinderella label and try and apply it to someone who is clearly never going to be the actual Cinderella.
Here's the thing about this, and I'm going to say the quiet part out loud it's not the happy, you know, it's not Cinderella, or it's more like Snow White, you know, trolloping around the forest with the little woodland creatures. Like, we're supposed to love that. I don't love it when that team gets to the Elite Eight, because they get buzzsawed in the Elite Eight, usually.
What about Butler?
Like the Sweet 16 we're going to get on Thursday and Friday, I like that. Like, I want those teams to win in the round of 64 and get destroyed in the round of 32, so they have the big dogs playing this week.
You want the Washington, D.C. regional that I'm covering this week, which is like four blue blood, right? Michigan State, UConn, St. John, and... Duke.
I'm fine with that, but I don't think it's the NCAA tournament unless you throw one wild card in there, a Santa Clara this year, you know, a Siena, something. I feel like that belongs.
It wasn't that long ago.
What, 4 years ago, 3 years ago? There usually is, right? What we're missing is one of those non-power five. Count the Big East, obviously, in that group.
Yeah.
So non-power five. In the Sweet 16, we've had it almost every year. It happens right in the last 2 years. It hasn't, which is alarming, because I think there is even just one win in the NCAA tournament. I think for some of these small schools, like High Point is a good example. Mm-hmm. I guess I saw somewhere where High Point's like applications like grew significantly just after the win, you know, the first win. Yeah, I think that is sort of missing, where you had a whole week of that if you won two games, and we're just we hadn't seen that the last 2 years.
I believe Wisconsin Green Bay, or was it University of Wisconsin Milwaukee.
Yeah, that was
young head coach named Bruce Pearl. That's how he got his first major gig. That's kind of how it used to work, right?
Like, I remember going to the Florida Gulf Coast after they were a 15.
Was that Dunk U?
Won. Dunk City.
Dunk City. That's what it was. Dunk City.
Dunk
What's
City.
The town, Andy?
Yes. Fort Myers.
Fort Myers. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dunk City.
So,
yeah.
But they've beaten Georgetown as a 15 seed, and then they won their round of 32 game. But yeah, they had that whole week, and like they had the dorm with a beach, and I did video stand ups from the beach outside the dorm with the players. Like it was unbelievable.
It's pretty awesome.
But yeah,
missing week of fun there.
They also got annihilated. Like I also covered their game against Florida and Dallas, where they got completely annihilated.
What about Butler? 60. You know, what about Butler? What about, Gonzaga is the perennial one that, you know, we always think Gonzaga is going to have the year.
But I think what has happened is those programs have just jumped up in conferences, too. It's a sort of two dance point. Gonzaga is a Pac-12 school that will play in the Pac-12 in every sport except football starting next year.
A friend of mine gave me a stat because I don't know anything about basketball recently. In the last, I believe it's 24 or 25 tournaments, a one seed has won the national title or UConn. In 24 out of the last 25, I believe, the only other school that wasn't a one seed or UConn to win the men's basketball tournament was Villanova.
Wow.
So it's chalkier than we realize.
Yeah.
I think what we're noticing
is... It's hard
is,
to win six games in a row unless you got a really, really
unless you're
good
deep
team.
And big. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things that's been passed around is a change in basketball itself and in strategy because people were using the three-point line as the equalizer for the longest time. You're seeing these big schools in the NIL era go back to playing multiple big men at the same time. There was a Todd Golden quote floating around the Florida coach that explained this really well. It's what everybody used to do 30 years ago. The game got away from that. Now the game is coming back to that because there are only so many athletic, huge people in the world. And so the big schools are probably going to be able to monopolize them.
I think the death of Cinderella is like, can be explained in three different parts. The realignment, football related, obviously.
Yeah. Yep.
The transfer portal, right? Where you have so many players that can move now up and that aren't just stuck at their mid-major programs. When they get developed enough, they can move up now. And then, of course, the money, right?
It's kind of part
and rev share in the money. Like, all these three things, I think, lead us to where we are, which is a conversation that's going to get really interesting if this trend continues over the next year or two, because the NCAA tournament's television contract ends in 2032.
The conversation I'm not ready to have yet.
Yeah.
Don't let your co-host hear this, Andy. Ari Wasserman, okay. On three. The conversation this is where we're headed, but I'm not ready to have it yet, is that basketball is comping or sort of providing a case study for the conversation we might need to have in football that I'm not ready to have
football.
Yet, which is
group
of five schools, G6 schools. Right. We may be eroding, we may be widening the gap in talent to a point where we're never going to see American Athletic Conference Houston beating Florida State in the Peach Bowl. We're never going to see again the Luke Fickell Cincinnati teams that go to the 4-team playoff or almost beat Georgia in the Sugar. Like, that gap may be widening more than those of us who love that level of football are willing to admit.
And that is a difficult conversation that we are going to have.
Yep.
Maybe. And there's later this offseason.
Yeah, and there's two postseason conversations. Does the NCAA tournament, when the contract runs out in 2032, become very different and more Power Five?
The Power Conference tournament.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Which and they've threatened in football, many, many times over the years to get what they want from a legislative standpoint. So,
and in football, does the G6 lose its automatic bid? I mean, that's the fear that many G6 commissioners and ADs have had for a very long time. And, after that contract runs out in 2031, there probably is a good chance that happens if the gap continues to grow.
Everybody in the Sun Belt, listen to me right now. Start running the triple and you drag them to hell.
Listen, you'll get no complaints from me.
That's what I'm talking about. That's God's plan.
I want an entire conference of triple option teams.
Oh, my God.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Next on the College Football Inquirer, should the entire ACC go to the triple? No, that's not what we're doing next. But we will talk to you on Thursday.